degrees. Sunday looks like rain with 59. Monday, Veterans Day, partly sunny and again 59. Right now, sunshine, 48 degrees, Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's all football today. Part one about a novel that concerns high school football. And then in part two, from the archives, a fascinating interview about the rise and fall of the USFL. Here's part one of today's program. And we're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with Gary Parker, who has been the author of a number of different books, including nearly 20 novels, the most recent of which is called The Playbook. And it tells a wonderful story about something we don't see actually all that often, a woman who is a football coach and dealing with the complicated lives and challenges of some of the young athletes with whom she is working. The Playbook is published by Bancroft Press, and it is a very, very compelling novel that I have been really enjoying reading and exploring. And I'm glad that we can have Gary Parker with us to talk about this particular work, which, by the way, he has transformed as well into a screenplay. Again, it's titled The Playbook. And Gary E. Parker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here with you and appreciate your time and being able to speak to your audience.
I would love to hear just a little bit about how you got into the writing business in the first place. What drew you to this right off the bat?
You know, as a kid in the sixth grade, we had a writer's contest for a short story. I won that, read my short story to the whole sixth grade class, and I guess I've been a writer ever since. And along the way, I had teachers and professors who encouraged me. I worked for newspapers for a while during college as an intern, and then at the Greenville News, where I attended Furman University. And then I wrote some articles, and then I wrote a nonfiction book, and it got published. And then I said, you know, I've always read novels, and so I want to write a novel. And I tried it and wrote it, and somebody paid me for it. So I kept having story ideas, and I kept writing the story ideas, and that's how it happened. It was kind of it really came out of my history as a reader. My dad in particular read, I can't remember a night when I went to bed that I didn't see my dad reading a book as he was going to bed. And so as a reader, it became, at least for me, a natural progression to become a writer. And that's sort of the beginning of it all.
By the way, you live in Atlanta, Georgia, but the photograph that I have seen of you in the book looks like you are in Lambeau Field and wearing a Green Bay Packers fleece. Or am I misreading that photo?
Yeah, you're misreading it. That's actually a Georgia G.
Oh.
And I'm at the Georgia Notre Dame football game from 2017, and that's where that picture is taken with the screen behind me and my wife and I. Georgia played Notre Dame that year, and we went up to Notre Dame because that's something I had always wanted to do. I wanted to get a picture by Touchdown Jesus and we got a picture in the stadium. So that's where that originated.
Interesting. Yeah. It's exactly the same letter G as our own Packers. Well, that is fine. We're glad you're a fan of Georgia, and you're a fan of a number of different sports. I mean, I read in a summary of your life that you were an accomplished athlete, but from the looks of it, football was not necessarily part of what you did. I mean, there were other sports in which you soccer, I think, and baseball. So when it came time for you to write this novel called The Playbook, you actually had to do some research in order to write authentically about the dynamics of a high school football team and what a coach does and so on. I'm just curious, what drew you to this? I mean, why isn't The Playbook about a baseball team and a baseball coach? What made you want to write about this specifically?
You're right. So I played middle school football. I was 6'3 and weighed 152 pounds when I was in high school. So I didn't play much high school football, but I'd played just enough to know how, a football team worked, because I did play 2 years as a ninth grader. And so I took that experience, and then I did my research on, certain things about football that I didn't know, but having played, I knew some. And I'm a huge college football fan in particular. And so I have been a student of football for a long time, but I wanted to write about football because it's such a cultural thing, and particularly in the Midwest, the Southeast, in the Texas, out in that. Not so much necessarily in the Northeast or the West, but it's such a cultural phenomenon. There are actually more people who watch in person high school football on a Friday night than watch pro football in person on a Sunday or on a Monday night. Now that's because there are a lot more high schools than there are pro teams, but it does still show millions of people every week watch high school football. And so that phenomenon is sort of the seedbed for the story that I wrote there.
You paint a really interesting picture with several of your central characters. And one I've already made mention of is a woman who is serving as a football coach. This is the character Chelsea Deal. And I love the way she is written. And I mean, she just sort of leaps off the page as a real human being. Tell our listeners more about who she is, her background, and how she finds herself in this particular position.
Well, first, thank you for saying that about her being a real human being, because that's the greatest compliment a writer can get. So I appreciate that. But, her backstory is really fabulous. She was she played high school football as a kicker, small college football as a kicker. So, and that wouldn't be beyond the pale of possibility now. You do have a few women who do that, a few young girls who play in some form or fashion on a football team. And then Chelsea's backstory is one of the real complicated issues of the book, is why is she a former big city lawyer, by the way, now the coach of a small North Georgia football team? And the antagonist of the story is one of the other coaches who didn't get the job when they promoted her, and he starts digging into her history. Why would she give up a job at a big city law firm making a lot of money to come and make little or nothing in a small North Georgia high school? So that backstory for Chelsea is one of the most moving experiences in the story. And toward the end of the book, she reveals that. And I won't reveal that to the audience here, but it's one of those moments where, as a writer, I actually got tearful as I wrote her backstory, what motivated her to end up where she is. And that story is really what drives her as a human being. One of the things about Chelsea is she says to the team very early on when she gets the job, she says, "I want you to know I love football, but I care more about you than I do football." Mm. And she proves that in the way she relates to two of the players in particular. Her starting quarterback, and I'll give a bit more information on this, is an African-American kid, brilliant, great leader. And he finds out the week after she gets the job, he finds out that he's got bone cancer. And the backup quarterback is a white kid, new in town, with a learning disability, a mom in rehab, and he loves music more than football. And so now you've got a woman coach an African-American starter with bone cancer and a white kid with all kinds of problems off the field and not really caring that much about football. And these three people try to come together with all of their differences and all of their adversities to try to make something happen on a football field. So that's kind of Chelsea's backstory, is a running issue of who is she and why is she there? The African-American quarterback with cancer and the white kid with all these issues, and the three of them trying to make sense in a small town. And, you know, my statement has been, this small town is not Mayberry. They have to deal with the same things in the small town that the people in the big cities have to deal with as well.
You, I think, write very authentically and persuasively about what the experience is like for Chelsea Deal as a high school football coach. And, you know, it's challenging enough. And then, you know, you add some other of the complications that you've already kind of touched on. Did you reach out to any women who are part of the world of football in this way to kind of get a sense of what that experience is like for them? Or were you just drawing upon your own imagination?
That's a great question. And I'm drawing on my own imagination, but it comes out of the experience of being a dad of two daughters who didn't play football, but they played soccer and basketball competitively. And so I sort of was like, okay, what if one of my daughters had wanted to be a coach, had wanted to play football as maybe a kicker out of their soccer background? And so both of these are accomplished women, strong, capable, smart, and yet feminine. And so I thought, okay, these are not my daughters, but she has some characteristics of my daughter. She's strong-willed, but not bullying or intimidating. She's a football coach, but she's feminine. She's got emotions, but she doesn't let her emotions rule her. Those are the kinds of composites that I sort of drew. Who are the strong women in my life, and what would they be like if they were in this circumstance?
I think the story here that is particularly powerful is about these two young men, Ty Rogers and Palmer Norman. You've already outlined the basics of their story, and I'm really glad that you did offer up the information that we learn fairly early in the book, that Ty Rogers, the starting quarterback, gifted, a great leader, great kid in so many ways, has been dealt the savage blow of a cancer diagnosis at the age of whatever he is, 17. And
right.
And of the connection that develops between him and this other young man, Palmer Norman, who ultimately ends up having to step into the breach as the team's new quarterback. What an intriguing idea, I mean, to make this really, in so many ways, the heart and soul of your novel. Tell our listeners more about what ultimately develops between these two and the relationship that you have crafted that emerges between them.
Yeah, the starting quarterback, the African-American guy, has to teach Palmer the playbook. And Palmer's got a learning disability. And so it's very difficult for him, and he gets frustrated, and he doesn't want to do it, again, because he loves music more. And so it's the Ty and Chelsea come together to work with Palmer to teach him the playbook. And out of this, you know, you've got this African-American kid and this white kid who don't know each other, really, and they're struggling. They're trying to figure out how to teach him the playbook. Palmer's trying to figure out how to learn the playbook. And over the story, as it develops, they realize they're becoming friends, and they're so different. And the stereotypes are changed around here some. The white player has the learning disability and the mom in rehab. So many times we see the African American player drawn as that, and yet here it's different. It's switched, and these two realize they're becoming friends. And what do they do with that friendship? How does that friendship play out on the field? And so as Ty gets sicker through the story and Palmer begins to get stronger through the story, will this friendship hold? And really, what is the basis of it? Is the basis of this friendship football, or is the basis of this friendship two young men, both of whom have their own adversities that they're dealing with, even as they work with Chelsea, who is dealing with her own adversities as well.
One of the things I appreciate is you are, for the most part, unflinching in terms of telling some of the darker sides of these stories, particularly the backstory of Palmer Norman, who comes out of such a difficult situation with a dysfunctional family, and so on. What kinds of things did you think about in terms of painting the picture of this particular character and who he is and the kind of life from which he has emerged?
You know, Palmer for me is a, I grew up in, I wouldn't say overly dysfunctional, but somewhat dysfunctional family, and many people did. And so it wasn't out of my experience, but it was somewhat drawn from, because we moved a couple of times when I was in school. You know, we had some family issues we had to deal with. And so I was drawing that character somewhat out of the, you know, he's new in town. He's got all kinds of fears. He's got this learning disability. Thankfully, I never had anything related to that. But he's got all these issues he's trying to grapple with as he's a young teenager. And there's, being a teenager is hard enough anyway. And you throw all this other stuff in on top of it, and it becomes even more difficult. And so the one thing that he's got that nobody else has is he's a musician. He plays the guitar. He sings. And that becomes, he's got this soulful, bluesy, kind of dark, hurt personality. But here on the football field, he's got a chance because he's highly athletic. If he can just learn the playbook, he can really become somebody. He's a new kid in town, but he can sort of make his way, prove himself on the football. But he's got to get through all these hurdles first. Mm-hmm. His mom shows up. She's left rehab before it's over, and now he's got to deal with her. You know, he's got the problem of can't learn the playbook, and he screws up in the game. So he's trying to fight all these adversities, trying to find his place, not just in this football, but in this community and really in life. That's kind of the overarching story of it all.
It's a great story. Last question. If I read this correctly, you have taken this novel and also adapted it into a screenplay. What kind of experience was that like for you?
Yeah, this actually started as a screenplay during COVID.
Ah.
And I've written a couple of screenplays. I've had one sold, one optioned, and so I've had some success. Nothing's gotten on the screen yet, but during COVID, when everybody was watching Netflix and Amazon Prime, everybody was trying to find something to watch because we were sitting at home, I thought, you know, there ought to be a story like this. And so I started writing it there, and then I said, I'm going to novelize this because I'd written novels. I knew how to write a novel. I didn't necessarily know how to write screenplays when I started, but it started as a screenplay. I've got it but completed as a screenplay. I actually have it completed as a 6-episode limited series with a chance for more seasons like Friday Night Lights or something. So it started in reverse order, something I'd never done. I had not taken a screenplay and made a novel. I had taken novels and made screenplays, but it's a very visual story anyway, and so that made sense to me. I wanted the story to have a life, even if it didn't ever make it to the screen, which I still have high hopes that it will.
Mm. Well, me too. I could imagine this being very effective on the screen. Well, in the meantime, it is right. An exciting and deeply moving novel published by Bancroft Press, again titled The Playbook. Gary E. Parker, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show, and best wishes with all of your future projects.
Super. Good to meet you. Good to chat with you.
It's 8:28. You're listening to The Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part 2 comes from The Morning Show archive. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we are talking about a very interesting football story, largely forgotten. And, of course, if someone is a little too young, they have probably no recollection or knowledge whatsoever of the USFL. But for several years in the 1980s, the USFL presented to the public a very special kind of professional football. And the story is also one that is riddled with all kinds of amazing, larger-than-life characters. A lot of missteps, a lot of terrible mistakes, and ultimately a doomed venture, but a fascinating story nonetheless, told by Jeff Perlman in a great new book called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Jeff Perlman comes to this as someone who followed the USFL pretty loyally back then, and has written a number of different books, including The Bad Guys 1, Boys Will Be Boys, Showtime, Sweetness, and Gunslinger. This new book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again titled Football for a Buck. And Jeff Perlman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I love the way the book begins with a story of you as a young person. I don't remember what year you were in school, but you needed to come up with an idea for, I guess you would say, an interesting research paper. Tell our listeners about this story and how it intersects with the USFL.
Well, I was a senior in high school, Mayo Pack, New York, in 1990. And the USFL had been dead for 5 years. And my AP English teacher, Mr. Height, gave us an assignment. We had to write a 20-page paper as our final paper. So I said I wanted to write about the USFL. And he wasn't that enthused, but he let me do it. And instead of handing in 20 pages, I handed in 40 pages. So my final paper, my senior of high school, was a 40-page paper called The Downfall of the USFL. And I just absolutely knew it was the greatest paper ever written by any human ever, and that he was going to love it, and it was going to blah, blah, blah. I ended up getting a B+, a very disappointing B+. And I can't even imagine, looking back, that any high school English teacher would take time to read 40 pages on The Downfall of the USFL. He probably skimmed it. It was like, yeah, B+ is good. Moved on with his life. That's what I would have done.
The thing is that what he wrote there was very telling. In a sense, it was a precursor of this book being written, when he wrote at the top of it, "Solid job, but I feel like there's much more to this story." And what you tell us, of course, is this is way back before you could Google something like the USFL. I mean, for someone of your age to try to find any meaningful information about the USFL after it had gone out of business was probably next to impossible.
Well, I used Nexus. I used newspaper archives, you know, and probably read through the New York Times. And I had a couple of, at that local library, they had some sporting good annuals. But it wasn't a ton. It wasn't like I got to interview a lot of people. I actually left. There was a phone number for the USFL on one of the back of the sporting good guides from 5 years earlier. And I remember leaving a message. Like, hey, because it actually had an answering machine for the USFL. I said, hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm a senior at Mayo High School, blah, blah, blah. Never heard a word. Never thought it. I'm sure the answering machine was in someone's basement, because the league had been dead for 5 years. I was just full of optimism without much knowledge behind it.
Well, at this late date, you have done an amazing job of bringing this story really vividly to life. And we again want to remind our listeners, the book is titled Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Tell our listeners about this New Orleans art dealer by the name of David Dixon. He is usually credited with being the person who kind of masterminded this in the first place. What was behind his idea of creating a new professional football league?
Well, he was a frustrated football fan who really wanted New Orleans to get a team, and for years the NFL would not give New Orleans a team. So he had this idea, if they're not going to do it, I'll start my own league. And he thought it's going to be a spring league. His big thing was you should have regional drafts. So if you were going to have a team in Florida, why not have it filled with guys who grew up playing in Florida? Have guys who played in Florida and Florida State, Miami. And he pushed his idea, but then the NFL gave New Orleans the Saints, and he kind of dropped it. And then, you know, a couple of decades later, he still always believed in the idea of spring football. His whole philosophy was, the only reason we have football in the fall is because Rutgers and Princeton played the first game ever in the fall, so we decided it's fall. There's no logical reason football has to be a fall sport. So we pushed forward with this league, got a bunch of older coaches who were excited about it, and sort of pushed and pushed. And finally, in 1982, really introduced it, the idea, in a press conference. And I mean, people were kind of excited by it, actually.
Hmm. One thing about this scenario which led him to create this rival league, you say that it occurred to Dixon, and you quote him saying, "It dawned on me that the NFL never in its history expanded willingly. They always expanded to head off competition." Can you explain why an organization like the NFL, at least for most of its history, would not want to willingly expand? What was it about the mindset of the NFL that made it so seemingly averse to the notion of expanding?
I mean, I think one of the things about the league that's interesting is it has always viewed itself, at least if all, maybe not always, but for the past 5 or 6 decades, with a great air of exclusivity. It was a genuine honor to get an NFL franchise. We were not just going to give these away. You know, you had to be special to get it. You have to jump through a lot of hoops to get it. It's not just something we will bring to you. It is much higher than that. And I think that actually turns off a lot of people, especially potential investors who want to get into the USFL, this idea that you have to be something special. And especially back then, it was all about old money families. It was the Rooneys and the Maras and these wealthy American families. And the idea that we would let someone, a New Orleans art dealer, what? You know, that's not the NFL. We don't do that. We need to know your money. So it was hard to break through. It was really, really hard to break through that in the NFL's view of itself.
Hmm. So they viewed themselves as quite the exclusive club and were not interested in expanding the club to let in new members in a sense. So when Mr. Dixon goes about trying to get this league off the ground, there's a lot of things he has to do, but of course one of the biggest things is to find willing and enthusiastic investors. And you say that he was looking for potential owners with two primary qualifications: deep pockets and large egos. I think the first point makes perfect sense. What about the second one? Why would he go out of his way to find potential owners with large egos? What was the point of that?
Well, I mean, to own a football team is to crave the spotlight and to crave people sort of listening to you and to being called Mr. Jones or Mr. Smith or whatever by, you know, legions of young superstar athletes. It's to be in newspapers and to hold press conferences. And, you know, Donald Trump, who later owned the New Jersey Generals, really said it well, which is, I can build the biggest skyscraper and maybe I get paid sixth on the post, kind of free safety away from the NFL, and I'm on the back page and the front page. So he just knew that one of the calling cards, it was the idea, it wasn't just the idea that it costs money. It was the idea, oh, I'm going to be famous. It was almost instant fame. A lot of these guys are just shopping mall developers. Nobody knew who they were. But once you get a professional football team, you're instant famous.
So just give our listeners a general idea of the kind of men who ultimately stepped forward to be those first owners of this brand new football league called the USFL.
Yeah, well, it was actually kind of an impressive group. Al Taubman of the Michigan Panthers was a developer. Miles Tannenbaum of the Philadelphia Stars, a wealthy developer. In Los Angeles, you had these two guys, Al Harmon and Bill Daniels, who were sort of pioneers in cable television. The New Jersey Generals were owned by J. Walter Duncan, who was a really wealthy oil man. They originally went with very, very deep-pocketed guys. If you looked at the list of men, maybe they didn't have the names of the NFL owners, but they definitely, for the most part, had the wealth, or at least on the same range of wealth as the NFL owners.
They had some good ideas, and one of them was that, let me quote you, because I think you say it really, really well. You said the players and coaches would play central roles in selling the product. Unlike the NFL, which seemed happy to hide its gladiators beneath helmets and shoulder pads and strict media guidelines, the USFL wanted its participants front and center, so there would be mid-game sideline interviews, extra media days, endless promotional appearances, and fan engagements. They seem to have an idea that adding this element could potentially make a big difference for the better.
Oh, yeah. It's like the recently passed Burt Reynolds was a minority partner at the Tampa Bay Bandits. And really what that meant is you'd see him on the sidelines. He'd be promoting goods. He'd be bringing celebrities with him. He'd be marching onto the field with women on each arm, you know, half-naked women on each arm. It was about free giveaways and, you know, crazy mascots. And, you know, the Tampa Bay Bandits hired Steve Spurrier as their head coach, University of Florida, former quarterback. And this is before he was a famous coach. He was Steve Spurrier, an offensive coordinator from Duke. And a big reason for that was he played at Florida. He was a hero at Florida. And now here he is, coaching the team. So they were really smart and sort of cagey about what they were doing image-wise early on.
Right. And, of course, they were also smart to try to broker some kind of a media deal. I mean, exactly in concert with the creation of the league itself. Without that, none of this would have worked at all.
Yeah, well, they were the first. I would argue they were the first professional sports league that was built specifically with TV in mind. The first commissioner was Chet Simmons from ESPN. They had ABC and ESPN deals very early on. ESPN at the time was sort of still a fledgling broadcast company, so it was a big deal. You know, at the time, ESPN was still showing like bowling and ping pong. So getting a football league and the rights was a big deal. So they were just thinking, they were thinking very heavily about TV, TV, TV. And yeah, attendance is important, but TV is crucial.
Of course, what's in some ways even more crucial than TV or any of the other things we've talked about is having players and hopefully some decent players on the field. And in many respects, one of the most important elements to your book is the story of these USFL teams trying to line up and sign players who can play good football for the fans. Help our listeners understand just what a tricky situation this was and what these owners had to do in order to try to find decent football talent and the lengths to which they went to try to make this happen, to populate their rosters.
Well, it was almost like it was part carnival and part search for football players. It was an APB for anyone, and the leaders of this were the Chicago Blitz, who were coached by the legendary George Allen, and the general manager was his son, Bruce Allen. And they would basically hold these open tryouts across the country, and they ended up trying out more than 3,000 people. And it would be everything from guys who played in North Alabama and Georgia to guys who were marginal high school players. It would be one-arm guys. It would be guys with one kidney. It would be guys with, you know, missing teeth. And it was, you know, they went to a prison to try out a guy who supposedly was good. It was just this massive, massive search for football players. And one of my favorite stories in the book is there was a guy named Albert C. Lynch, who I'd never heard of before. But everyone with the Blitz brought up Albert C. Lynch. He was a guy, he wasn't a football player, but he tried out. He was terrible. And it was at a Soldier Field in Chicago, and he noticed what the Blitz were doing. Was the few players who were being kept from these tryouts, very few, would walk up into the stands to meet with Bruce Allen and sign a contract. So Albert Lynch, who was terrible, ended his workout. It was a joke. And he went to the stands, and Bruce Allen saw him, and he signed him to a contract. And later on, Bruce Allen's meeting with the coaches of the Blitz, and they're like, why did you sign Albert C. Lynch? He said, what do you mean? You sent me Albert C. Lynch. He's like, no, he didn't. No, you did. He came right up. They couldn't figure it out until later that Albert C. Lynch had figured out their system and broken through and earned a mini camp invitation. But there's a lot of, you know, like the Tampa Bay Bandits were convinced they had the former Miami Dolphin kicker, Gary Upremian, in camp because there was a guy who looked just like Gary Upremian. And they kept calling him, hey, Gary, thanks for coming. And he'd say, well, I'm happy to be here. And it turns out it was some guy named like Saul Sausman who just looked like Gary Upremian but couldn't kick like him.
Right. And, of course, on a slightly more serious note, many of these would-be players for the USFL and many who ended up being players for the USFL were people who had criminal records, many of them drug convictions, very serious substance abuse. And it just seems like this was, well, you called it a circus at one point or carnival, and it seemed like it was exactly the scenario in which people who had these kind of issues dealing with these kind of demons would be left to those demons.
Yeah, it was really like the show. It was Last Chance U. And I mean, the classic example is Joe Gilliam, who had been the Terry Bradshaw's backup quarterback with the Steelers, signed by the Denver Gold, then released, then signed by the Washington Federals. And Joe Gilliam had real drug issues, and he wasn't over them. And in fact, he was picked up by Rick Vaughn, the PR guy for the Federals, for his press conference. And he asked if they stop at a package store so he can get a beer. And he's driving to the press conference with a beer. And he spends his time with Washington as a quarterback of the Federals, either living in a halfway house or living in his automobile.
No wonder you call it at one point the Football League of blissful, colorful, dynamic excess. Yeah. Of course, one thing that makes a huge difference in terms of this USFL gaining credibility that it did not have was with the signing of a certain player by the name of Herschel Walker, or just the act of him being seriously interested in the USFL made a really, really big difference. Explain to our listeners why Herschel Walker was such a big deal at this moment in time in the history of the USFL.
I mean, for people who either weren't around or don't remember, Herschel Walker wasn't just, he won the Heisman Trophy at Georgia, but he wasn't just a Heisman Trophy winner. He was kind of Jim Thorpe, Bo Jackson, larger than life, used a successful player, big, strong, powerful, polite, and he also happened to be from a very poor family in Wrightsville, Georgia. And after his junior year at Georgia, he just decided, I want to go pro. I want to make money to support my family. But the NFL at the time wasn't taking – you had to be a senior to be in the draft. But he wasn't. So his agent reached out to the USFL, and the USFL really, really debated this one back and forth. Do we want to – because once we start going after juniors, how's that going to play out? How are fans going to respond? Are colleges going to allow us on their campuses? And ultimately what they decided was it was worth – the risk of it all, that the impact that he could have on this league would be huge. And they basically let him play, decide where he wanted to play. He picked New York, New Jersey. They gave him a $1 million, which was unheard of at the time. He immediately became the highest paid player. Hmm. And he put the USFL on the map.
So explain just how successful the USFL was in its first season.
Well, depends what your measure is.
Right.
They were very successful in signing away players the NFL wanted out of the college draft. I mean, along with Herschel Walker, they got guys like Craig James out of SMU and Tim Spencer from Ohio State, you know, Trumaine Johnson from Grambling and Reggie Collier from Southern Miss. They were getting big-time guys. Some of the teams were very successful. The Philadelphia Stars were great. The Michigan Panthers were great. Other teams were ridiculously unsuccessful. The Washington Federals, probably average about 8,000 to 10,000 fans. The LA Express didn't average many fans. It was just really hit or miss, and it depended on how well run the organizations were. Some organizations were run by fantastic general managers who would have long NFL careers. Other guys were run by paper pushers who had no idea what they were doing whatsoever. Only one team made money. It was the Denver Gold. They made a tiny bit. But part of the deal with the USFL was you were going to lose money before you make it. Mm. So it wasn't an expectation of getting rich immediately.
Right. One of my favorite stories in the team is the Federals, who had almost nobody coming to their games. I mean, they were one of the teams that really struggled mightily. You tell us that in a desperate attempt to generate some new interest, the organization held a T-shirt giveaway for the first 10,000 people to enter the stadium. And less than 7,000 people showed up, so they had leftover T-shirts from a $10,000 T-shirt giveaway. That's just that kind of gives us a sense of how many of these teams were really struggling to get fans in the stands. There was no reason to come when the level of play was so drastically uneven compared to
right.
the NFL.
Well, the Federals are really funny because they were terribly run. Their general manager, the Redskins are really, I mean, the Federals are really excited because they hired the Washington Redskins assistant general manager to be their general manager, Dick Myers. But Dick Myers had never been a personnel guy. He was just the guy who handled the financials. So he comes and he doesn't really know what the heck he's doing. And the best Federal story is they played the first game in USFL history. It was them against the Chicago Blitz. And in the lead up to that game, the Chicago Blitz coach, George Allen, sent two of his employees dressed in USFL windbreakers with cameras, with video cameras, to Federals practices, convinced the USFL film crew, videotaped their practices, and the Blitz knew every play they were going to run and just destroy them.
Yeah, whatever it takes. Talk about a kind of a wild, wild west of professional football. Well, at the end of that season, a decision is made that turns out to be a very ill-conceived decision for the USFL to expand. I mean, in sharp contrast, of course, to the NFL that we were talking about earlier, that never wanted to expand at all. The USFL was all too eager to expand. Just explain why that choice made so little sense financially and otherwise.
Well, the idea was we need more money, and it costs $6 million for each team, so we'll be getting a lot of influx. But the markets they picked were pretty bad. I mean, some were okay. Houston was a good market. It seems like Pittsburgh might have had the potential. But then they also expanded into San Antonio and Tulsa. And the Tulsa one's really funny. The team was supposed to be in San Diego. Then the owners at the San Diego Stadium Authority wouldn't allow the USFL in their stadiums, so they had to pick a different market. The University of Tulsa Athletic Department told the potential owners of the team that the football team drew 30,000 fans. Tulsa. Well, that turned out to be a lie. They were only drawing 17,000. But the USFL being the USO, they didn't actually research that. So they show up and they expect they're going to have these big crowds, but nobody's coming to the games because of the fictitious crowd totals that they were given. And San Antonio was even worse. They're playing in a high school stadium called, Alamo Stadium, with really bad artificial turf and crummy conditions and a relatively disinterested populace. So expand by two teams, maybe three or four. I guess you could maybe make an argument, but six teams was just insane.
Hmm. And yet it was interesting what they were doing, the product they were creating. You quote a running back for the Memphis Showboats saying the NFL was boring, the games were boring, the practices were boring, everything was boring. The USFL wasn't as good as the NFL, but it was 10,000 times more fun. And he may be speaking of what it was like for the players and maybe for certain fans, perhaps as well, at least for those successful teams. The other thing, though, that begins to, as a precursor of the USFL's demise, is actually when Donald J. Trump comes on the scene as one of its new owners. First of all, he shows up very early in your book because it looks at first like he's going to be one of the first owners of the USFL, but apparently backs out at the last second. What lured him back to the USFL?
Well, he really wanted an NFL team, and he saw that the USFL had a pretty good first season, and he knew the New Jersey owner, Walter Duncan, wanted to sell because he was based in Oklahoma, and he just found it really annoying to own a team in New York, New Jersey. So Donald Trump overpaid for the team. Walter Duncan was requesting $8 million. Donald Trump offered $10.5 million, which he took very quickly and happily. And, he in the lead-up to buying the team, he was all about spring football. He loved the USFL, and USFL is great, and this is fantastic. And as soon as he got the team, we need to move to fall. Fall's where it's at. We have to go to fall. He held a secret meeting with Pete Rozelle, the NFL commissioner, where he told him, I don't want to be in this league. I want the NFL. What do I have to do to get in the NFL? I mean, he's basically selling out the USFL behind his back. Pete Rozelle, told him, you'll never be an owner in the NFL. Again, the exclusivity of the league did not lend itself to sort of what Pete Rozelle saw as a charlatan, a new money charlatan. So Donald Trump, really, he just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed for fall, convinced the other owners there was much more money to be made in fall, guaranteed them he would get a TV deal in the fall, so that the networks were fascinated by fall TV. Now, this was all fiction. None of this was true. It was all complete and total lies. But he just really sort of wanted to be in the NFL, and he thought the best way to do it was to force the NFL's hands and either sue them or just have them naturally decide to merge and absorb a bunch of teams.
So he wanted to take it to them the same way the old AFL took it to the NFL, and obviously that led to the merger and the NFC and AFC division. He thought a similar scenario was going to come true, and he somehow convinced the other USFL owners to go along with what, of course, now in retrospect seems like an absolutely crazy idea.
Yeah, well, he was in a position of power because the Chicago team, the LA team, and the Washington teams were all really struggling, and he was the big market left. So he had this power. He sat in this position that they did not sit in, and they listened to him. He's very convincing. Not all of them did. There's one owner, John Bassett, the Tampa Bay Bandits, who viewed him as just, he said to the New York Times, I can't believe we're listening to this con man. I can't believe this, because Bassett really believed in the idea of spring football. And he saw this guy come along and just step all over it. It's a very interesting passage, prologue sort of thing with Trump. John Bassett, the owner of the Bandits, was diagnosed with brain cancer in 1984. And as he started to weaken, you know, Trump just walked all over him and saw it as the elimination of an enemy. And when John McCain was diagnosed with brain cancer, and Trump started to walk all over him and saw him as, you know, sort of a guy I could get out of the way, I feel like it was a very similar circumstance all these years later.
Interesting. Well, at any rate, enough owners go along with this idea of Donald Trump to shift to the fall, that the move, in fact, is made. Explain just how badly this turned out.
Oh, it ruined it. It just killed the thing. I mean, they had a lawsuit. They went to court. Trump was awful. He was their star witness. Roy Cohn was the attorney. He promised everyone that with Roy Cohn as the attorney, the NFL was going to want to settle. That did not happen. It was just, everything was a disaster. I talked to one of the jurors who said that Trump was the worst witness she's ever seen, that he tried intimidating them, staring them down. You know, he was unlikable. The NFL found their bully. It needed a bully and found it in Donald Trump. And, you know, no. And he was ultimately rewarded a dollar. And it was the death of it all.
So just describe then what would amount to the final days, maybe the final hours of the USFL. I mean, what ensured that they simply had to go out of business?
They had no money. Once they lost the lawsuit, you know, they were suing for $1.3 billion. They won a dollar. The economy. It was just they ran out of money. The owners were dispirited. Donald Trump was like, I'm done with this. That means the New York franchise was over. The plan for fall was dead. But they just didn't have anything left. And it was embarrassing. It was a public humiliation at the hands of the NFL. And there was some talk, oh, we're going to continue, we can continue. But everyone pretty much knew it was over. Also, the players were under contract, and they couldn't afford to keep them under contract. So they basically had to let everyone go, and that was it. It was a really sad ending to what I thought was a great, great league.
It's really an amazing story. It's interesting how, for all of the dark elements of it, there is also, to some extent, it's also the story of a lot of guys who love to play football, and that's what it was about for them, a chance to play football in kind of a new scenario, not quite as stuffy as the NFL, and the potential of really injecting refreshing new life into the whole landscape of professional football. I suspect that as you investigated it, you began to see that probably more and more.
Oh, it's the most heartbreaking thing of it all. I mean, a couple of years ago, Mike Tolan produced a 30 for 30 called Small Potatoes about the USFL. And Donald Trump was quoted as saying in it, you know, he was very angry. He did not like talking about the USFL ever. This was a huge failure for him. And in it, he called the USFL, hey, it was just small potatoes. And that line infuriated USFL players and infuriated me, because it wasn't small potatoes to most of those guys. For most of those guys, most of those guys in the USFL were not Steve Young or Jim Kelly or Herschel Walker. They weren't guys making millions of dollars. They were the guys who, maybe they were a wide receiver who ran a 4.7 40 when the NFL was looking for a 4.5. Maybe they were offensive linemen who were 280 pounds when the Jets wanted at least 290. You know, they were guys who were given a shot to live a football dream, and they were living it. And, I mean, I interviewed one guy who played for the Portland Breakers, and every day, still to this day, the first thing he does when he wakes up in the morning is look at the team photo for the Portland Breakers 1985, because he considers it a sort of fruition of a dream for him. So when that was taken away and when that dies, it crushed these guys. It absolutely crushed these guys, and most of them, the vast, vast majority of USFL players, even though almost 200 went on to have play at least at some point in the NFL, the vast majority of guys who played in the USFL never played football again.
What a loss for them. And, of course, it was thanks to plain old greed and arrogance as much as anything that led to the demise of this league.
Yep. And
the story is told very, very well in your wonderful book called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author, Jeff Perlman. Jeff Perlman, thank you so much for writing such a great book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We want to let you know that there will be no morning show broadcast on Monday. The studio will be closed because of Veterans Day, but there will be a morning show podcast available to you, and over the weekend, of course, as well. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg to enjoy The Morning Show 7 days a week. Today's going to be a sunny day, and we're headed for a high of 58 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.